You can turn in your Bibles to James chapter 4, and we're going to pick up kind of where we left off last week, but so good. I love, baby dedications I think are the sweetest thing, and we just love you guys. So good to have you here, and man, praying with Everett through all that and with you guys through all that, and God is so faithful and good. Well, as we're kind of flipping in our Bibles there, I want to start with a little check-in this morning. How are you doing as we go through James? Are you seeing the effects? Because, see, if you're not, James is going to say you're doing something wrong. That as we go through this book, we're not signing up for an instructional class on wisdom. We're not trying to increase our biblical knowledge per se. We're trying to change our lives, right? And for James, this is important. He's saying if you're reading and studying this book and it's really doing its work, then it should change your language. The words that you say, and not just what you say, but how you say them, the whole texture of what you say should be affected. And you should catch yourself when you slip. We've talked about this idea that James is there to create self-awareness. It's there to hold a mirror up, to say, look at what you're doing. Look at what you're saying. How is it reflective of God's kingdom? It's pointing us to our own hearts, not just what we do, but again, why we do it. Is this coming from a place of jealousy? Is this coming from insecurity, ambition, a need to promote ourselves over others? Do we notice the tension in our own hearts, the kind of war of the passion that's going on there? All these things, James is saying, notice these things, recognize, see yourself doing it, catch yourself doing it, and in a way like tell on yourself, right? Most of us, when we see that, we minimize or we deflect or we blame. And he's saying, no, you need to own these things. Take responsibility for them, feel their weight, and behave different. Are you growing in wisdom? If you are, then you should be becoming more gentle. You should be open to reason. You should be full of mercy. You should be impartial, sincere, sowing seeds of peace. And we've signed up for like James' fitness workout plan, right? And if you're not doing this more than just one day a week, you're probably going to not see too much change. Be like signing up for a nutrition or fitness thing and go, you know what, I'm going to just do it on Sundays. Sundays I'm going to do a hard workout, I'm going to eat right, and the rest of the week I'm not going to worry about it. What sort of results are you going to see? We all know you're probably sliding the other way. But if you're staying with it, if you're building a routine and you're starting to grow in momentum, you should be seeing change. Moving towards what James is going to call maturity or wholeness, completeness. And he's saying this is the plan, this is the purpose, and we live in a world that needs it. Christians who aren't just knowing it, but doing it. This from 1:22 of James, he says, do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. And a little later in 2:18, but someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Are we becoming a church that is filled with faith? If we are, then we're going to feel the effect. And not just us, but our little community around, who all felt the effects of our worship today, I'm sure. And it's sweet, like when I talk to the neighbors, they say, oh, we love, I hope they're being sincere, we love listening to the music on Sundays. It's an example of how that like permeates out, right? How the goodness and the love of God isn't just changing our own hearts, but it's spilling out of us. It's creating goodness and mercy that follow us as we go through life. Now, last week we talked at the start of chapter 4 about kind of the state of our hearts, how there's this war that's going on. And Jeremiah tells us the heart is sick, it's deceived, that there's something in it that is turned inward, that like wants to worship itself. And another part of us that is made to be in intimacy and belonging, to live lives of meaning connected to God. And that this battle that's going on, this war, like who is getting the upper hand is going to have everything to do with who we feed like two dogs in a fight, right? The one that wins is the one you feed the most. We feed our ambition, our self-centeredness, our own desires or insecurities. That part of us starts to grow. It starts to take over. And that becomes then the texture of the fruit. You bite into it and it doesn't taste right. But when we are following along with where God is leading, when we're yielding to the challenges that he puts forth in our lives, we begin to soften and to change. The fruit tastes ripe. And this war in our hearts, part of the desire, the wrong desire is this. It's like the youngest son in the prodigal son story that goes, I want this. He's saying, you're praying to God, but you're praying out of this selfish ambition. You want to take this power of God and use it for your own means. And so James tells us the way back, the way in, the way into belonging, the way home is this road of repentance. It's a soft heart. It's humility. It's a teachable spirit. Like he says, that wisdom that's open to reason. It's willing to look at truth, even the hard truth, and to face it. It doesn't look and see it and then turn away and forget it. It stares at it and it lets that truth become its instructor and it yields its heart. And so for James, he's going to say, if you really want to grow, if you want to become wise, the way is submission. In James 4, 6 through 8, it says, therefore it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. And in humility, we come like under the shadow of God's wing. We come into this place of protection and intimacy. That's where submission leads us. I love as Ray kind of opened up, he was talking about the dance and this sort of all of us find ourselves in this role of being led, willing to be led. And submission is a word that because of, I think, plenty of abuse, it sounds like a loss of freedom, but this is not how that word would have been originally understood. That submission was seen as like the greatest expression of our freedom. To choose to submit, to choose to yield, to lay down ourselves. Makes me think of that Bob Dylan song that says, everybody's going to serve someone. And see, that heart that's turned inward isn't free. It's a slave to itself, a slave to those passions and those desires. And as it turns out, so much of those selfish desires suck the life out of us. And they come with guilt, they come with baggage. That by submitting to God, we're yielding to the life that's going to make our hearts come alive, to thrive, to grow. So embracing submission, embracing truth, is this way of yielding to the intimacy of God and allowing ourselves to be led. When we run from this, it's like avoiding going to the doctor when we feel a pain. Anybody do that? Right? Like, maybe it'll just go away. And I think oftentimes spiritually this is what we do. We start feeling the effects and then we start thinking, maybe this will just go away on its own in time. If I go to the doctor, I may hear worse news than I want to hear. This is the kind of self-deception that happens, and it's not just over our physical health. It's, I think, by far more common in our spiritual lives. We try to do it on our own, and we do it through this sort of selective ignorance. Submission takes us into that place of truth and allows our hearts to hear what is really going on. And when we do, this is the invitation, and the reason that submission is such a wonderful invitation, that what we're being invited into is a God who knows us so intimately, who sees where this small self, this self-centered self, is holding us back. This God who knows just what to do to bring us alive. Psalm 139, David writes this, for you created me in my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How many people do you think that pertains to? Turns out every one of you, right? That the shepherd, the one who knows you, the one who's drawing you, is somebody who knows you so intimately. Knows all that's ahead. Knows just what you need. And this passion experience within us that's at war, God is trying to set us free from that so that we would become single-minded, pure of intent. This is how we come alive. But often the way that God does it is through a sort of pruning. And most of us don't like when that happens. God has this way of coming into our life and bringing things in there that just don't fit with our agenda. And when it comes in, it's inconvenient. It's frustrating. God comes in and sometimes disappoints. God comes in and sometimes takes that door that looked open, that was so obvious, and shuts it. And we go, what is going on? And I think God again and again is saying, trust me. Submit and trust just go hand in hand. And to yield to God, I think, is the wisest thing that we can do. But it takes courage. It takes faith. When we're living in this place of submission, what comes out is the wisdom that we spoke of. When we're going against this, I think that we see certain tells. And James is going to give us two of those today. That when we're not living in that place of submission, how do we know? Well, first off, our words become critical. And our decisions become independent and filled with a need to control. And these two things, I think, are really helpful because, again, they give us a lens to see our own hearts and our own motives laid bare. So 4:11 through 12, we got the slide for that. He says, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? Now, judgment. Does anybody enjoy judging others? It feels good, right? It's a way of like reflecting on truth in such a way that it sort of lifts you up to the moral high ground. And who doesn't like that, right? I think of that. There's kind of not a conversation you have where it doesn't at some point sort of shift over into that. I think about this. This is something that will happen from time to time. We'll be with like a small group gathering and somebody will say, you know what I love about this church? And somebody else will go, oh yeah, I love this about this church. And then somebody will go, yeah, you know what the last church I was at? Right? And the whole thing shifts and the whole thing changes. And I think it's such a natural sort of thing for us when we speak that judgment creeps in. We say something good and somebody else says something good and then somebody goes, ah, but, right? And as we do, the reason that we do, kind of how we get sucked into that, is there's a sort of intimacy that's formed through judging others. Not only does it make us feel good about ourselves, but if we together judge somebody else, it kind of feels like a bond. We feel connected, right? I saw somebody post something, you know, this week saying, like, if a friend of yours is willing to gossip about another friend of yours to you, like, guess what? They're gossiping about you when they're together, right? And this is just the truth of the matter, right? That gossiping or judgment isn't like a sort of isolated moment. It's a pattern that forms. It's a way of us trying to find our value in a sort of comparison, right? That there's only so much worth out there. That love and that value is something that's scarce, so we have to fight for it. If we understand that we are God's beloved, knit by Him in our mother's womb, this God who has all this intention and purpose, then we are free from this comparison. All we have to be is ourselves. But what happens when we criticize is we come out from underneath that place of submission and we start to like take some ownership of that. We start passing judgment as if we are the lawgiver. And as we do, sin enters in. I love this proverb, Proverbs 10:19 says, when words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise. In this way of just sort of restraining this, right? To, as you find yourself entering in, best thing you could do is notice it and halt it. Stop it right there. Or if somebody across the table from you goes, yeah, but all you have to do is not respond, change the subject. You don't have to condemn it. You don't have to like judge that person for their judging. Just allow it, just hold your tongue. And this is what James is saying. Like, you have all these ideas, but like, how do you put that into basic practice? Don't participate. And in doing it, it brings a sense of conviction, but a healthy conviction that generally switches the conversation. James is going like, who do you, when you criticize, when you judge, who do you think you are? And this is an important question. It shows how quickly we get self-deluded. We like to think of ourselves as having it all together, but this goes back to the very nature of sin, which is pride and ego that promotes itself, that puts itself in a position of authority. Submission is letting go of that. This doesn't mean that we don't use discernment, because we do. And if you read through Proverbs, it's going to talk about the fool, and it's going to talk about the wicked man. And it's going to talk about noticing and seeing these things in others. That sounds like judging, but it's not. It's noticing and responding with wisdom and humility and love, but not getting sucked into those things, not letting that become where our hearts are at. So criticism, it's a warning that we've come out from underneath the authority of God. We're acting in our own authority. We're pretending to be the lawgiver. The second thing, verses 13 through 17. We're moving a little fast this morning. We've got a full morning. We're going to take communion in just a sec. So bear with me here. But verse 13 says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make profit. You do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. And it as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is a sin. So again, you read this on the surface, or you're reading it kind of quick, and it almost sounds like, hey, you know what? Don't worry about tomorrow. Which, you know, I mean, Jesus taught that. Don't worry about tomorrow. And yet, if you go back to Proverbs, it's going to say, plan for the future. You need to save your money, right? Go to the ant, you sluggard. Look at the diligence, right? This is not giving you a pass to spend all your savings today because you may die tomorrow. It's not saying that. It's getting at the independence that, like, is setting its plans and its goals for its life apart from God. Like James said at the beginning of chapter 4, you're jealous of these people, but you're not even praying and asking God. Or when you do ask, you ask for the wrong motives. And when we plan with the wrong motives. Think about that question. What do I dream for? What do I long for? I think part of the reason I don't pray about those is because I'm sort of embarrassed about what I long for. Like, oh, what do I long for? To be comfortable. What do I long for? For a nice, easy life. And really good waves. That I'd be adored and I would live forever. Right? These are like my ambitions, right? You see God going like, oh gosh, Jeff. When we pray, we take these things and we hold them loosely. It's interesting. James is talking about these traveling merchants, which would have been like the entrepreneurs of the day. These are like the Silicon Valley guys. They're the powerful, the rich. They can afford to not only travel, but to go set up their franchises here and there and make a profit. They're probably the ones that everybody's catering to in church, as he rebukes them earlier, for giving the seat in the front to the rich and neglecting the poor. But the arrogance of our lives, any of us that have like money left over at the end of the day have this ability to sort of determine where we're going. And the more money you have, the more control it seems that you have, until all of a sudden, it's over. And James, it sounds kind of morbid, but he's going like, hey, you're going to die. And part of submission is coming to terms with that fact, that this life is short. There's only so much here. The way we live matters, but matters not just for this life, but for the one to come. A worldly wisdom is going to take all their means and invest it here and now in this world. As much pleasure, as much ambition, as much achievement as possible. We're going to fight aging with everything we've got and try to stay forever young. We're going to ignore ailments. We're going to hide from those truths and those realities. And James is saying, listen, when you let go of this idea of like trying to clutch onto your life and take this posture of open-handedness, you can actually savor and value the moment. When we're trying to control and live forever, we're stuck between this place of regret of our past and anxiety of our future. With open hands, there's actually the opportunity for joy. Each day becomes a gift. Each moment becomes potentially our last. So let's be present. Let's savor it for all the goodness. I think so often we have these goals and we think, if I could just get there, I'll be happy. And then we just keep kicking that can down the road, don't we? Just a little bit more, a little bit more. I think oftentimes God is coming in and breaking my ambitions only to show me that there's more. As it says in Corinthians, no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, nor mind can comprehend what God has in store for those who love him. So he comes in and disrupts our plans. And you ever been in that situation where you're looking at something that's happening, you're going, God, what are you doing? This doesn't make sense. And God's saying, hey, trust me, I'm with you. Read this quote. This, I think it's Tom Berryman here. He's the one who mentioned this quote to me, but I love it. This is from James Finley. He says, love protects us from nothing, even as it unexplainably sustains us in all things. Let me read that again. Love protects us from nothing, even as it unexplainably sustains us in all things. Access to this love is not limited by our finite ideas of what it is or what it should be. Rather, this love overwhelms our abilities to comprehend it, as it so unexplainably sustains us and continues to draw us into itself and all that life might send our way. And I think this, as we go through life, oftentimes we find discouragement, we suffer, we go through trials, and James is saying, consider them joy. Why? Because in the midst of those, God is there sustaining us with his love. God never steps aside or abandons, but instead, like our shepherd, goes through those places with us. This life is a vapor. To put that in Laguna terms, June gloom. It's there, it's sort of a mist, and then throughout the day, it fades away. Let me geek out for just a second. Tolkien, in his Lord of the Rings, says that God gave man mortality as a gift. That the elves were made for this world and lived forever and would grow weary. But humans are made for something more. And their life is short, and therefore there's moments filled with moments of joy and the reminder that they're made for something more. My worldly ambitions are always too small, and God is constantly trying to get us to live in light of heavenly goals, heavenly ideals, a heart, goals big enough for eternity. And what we do here on earth, what we do is small. It's like loaves and fish, but what we do with them when we surrender is we participate in something much bigger than us. I have to tell you about this moment. I'm going to brag about Don Majors, who goes to our church, who's not here right now. And the reason he's not here is he's really struggling. He's battling pancreatic cancer and has been leading our men's group as we've gone through Jonah. And has wanted to bring it to a close, but has been in so much pain. And so this last Tuesday, I was like, Don, it's all right, I got you covered. You know, like, stay home, relax, feel better. And he goes, Jeff, let me do it. And had to basically be helped upstairs to lead this group. And everybody that was there, I think, would be quick to say it was holy ground. And I'm thinking, okay, confession time, and I don't mean this like I take my job for granted, but how many times am I like, oh, I got to teach that tonight. I better come up with something. And to see somebody there going, let me teach. And to go, there's somebody who is pouring his heart out. And how all of us have this opportunity to live each day with that sort of significance. All of a sudden, the little things are not so little when we realize this may be my last one. Right? That's how we should hold on to our lives. That the meals, the time together, the connections, the relationships, all of these things are gifts from God. Joys that are here and fleeting, they're there for this moment. And at the same time, we participate in something so much bigger. And that while this life is short, we're being prepared for the next one. I'm going to read a quote for you guys. We're going to go a couple minutes late, but it's worth it. This, I want to read a quote from, it's an essay called Man or Rabbit by C.S. Lewis. And it's this question, can we live a good life apart from God? And he says, the idea of reaching a good life without Christ is based on a double error. Firstly, we cannot do it. Secondly, in setting up a good life as our final goal, we've missed the very point of our existence. Morality is a mountain which we cannot climb by our own efforts. And if we could, we should only perish in the ice and unbreathable air of the summit, lacking those wings with which the rest of the journey has to be accomplished. For it is from there that the real ascent begins. The ropes and axes are done away, and the rest is a matter of flying. Is that awesome? It's going like new creation. That James isn't written about how to be a good person. It's like how to become a new creation. How to be the type of person where heaven is where you belong. And this is what we yield to on a daily basis in the little things, in the faithful decisions. As we place our trust in God, we change. Like Lewis would say, we start to sprout wings. That climbing to the top of that mountain isn't far enough. We find ourselves there in our own strength at the end of that journey, incapable of going further. But the work that God is doing in purifying our hearts is making us new, bringing us alive, making us so that heaven is where we belong, the home that we're returning to. Some questions for us today. Where do I find myself playing judge? What am I threatened by in those I criticize? Because you are, by the way, when you judge. There's something in there that's threatening. How do they remind me of my own weaknesses, and how can they help me grow? So turning that criticism into an opportunity to look deeper at the work God is wanting to do in your heart. Number two, am I inviting God into my dreams and my plans? Am I willing to trust God when he is saying no? Do I really believe that he has my best in mind? That simple prayer of Jesus in the garden, not my will, but your will be done, right, is a way of detaching ourselves, clutching to those dreams, holding them with open hands. And three, how can I increase my practice of submission? I said, find times during the day when you can recalibrate, repent, and readjust. Catch yourself in that. Bring yourself back into that place. Practice that prayer of bringing yourself back under the will of God, back into that place of protection and intimacy, letting God come in and sustain you in the midst of it.